Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today we talk with Dr. Lawrence Rubin, an associate professor in the Sam Nunn School of International Affairs at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and a faculty affiliate at the Center for International Strategy, Technology, and Policy. His research interests include Middle East politics and international security, with a specific focus on Islam and politics, Arab foreign policies, and nuclear proliferation. He has conducted research in Morocco, Egypt, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. Professor Rubin is the author of the book, Islam in the Balance, Ideational Threats in Arab Politics, and co-edited and contributed to the volume, Terrorist Rehabilitation and Counter-Radicalization, New Approaches to Counterterrorism. He has published other works in scholarly outlets such as the International Studies Review, Politics, Religion, and Ideology, Middle East Policy, the British Journal of Middle Eastern Studies, the Brookings Institute, the National Interest, and Over Yonder at the Washington Post. Prior to Georgia Tech, Lawrence was a research fellow at the Belfair Center for Science and International Affairs, also with the Dubai Initiative in Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, and was a lecturer via the Robert and Myra Kraft Chair in Arab Politics at the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. Outside of academia, he has held positions at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies and the RAND Corporation. Like your fuzzy little host on this podcast, Professor Rubin received his PhD in political science from UCLA. Go Bruins, number two in the basketball polls this week. And he also earned degrees from the University of Oxford, London School of Economics, and UC Berkeley. His research has been supported by the Hollings Center for International Dialogue, the Institute of Global Cooperation and Conflict, the U.S. Department of Education, Horowitz Foundation for Social Policy, the Project on Middle East Political Science, and the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. Whew, that's a lot of stuff with some long titles. Larry, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I should tell the listeners that I have been out of town for a couple months, so we've had to run some reruns and encore presentations, but we are back to live podcasting with some new fresh episodes. So please, folks, check your feed and tell other folks that we are coming with you. Some really cool stuff later. But today we want to talk to you because you have a very interesting and timely topic. The focus of our talk will be about your recent book, Islam in the Balance, Ideational Threats in Arab Politics. Middle East is always in the news here, so it seems like this would be an obvious topic to study. How did you end up studying this topic?
Yeah, that's a great question. It kind of comes together as a number of interests that I have in both, as you can tell, Middle East, from that side of things, and these broader international security interests. And even within the Middle East, I kind of, within the academic field, focus as one needs to on both comparative and international relations. But it's usually about international relations that drives a lot of the questions. And I came to this topic by I was trying to investigate. I remember in the 2000s doing both combining field work and language study and trying to figure things out with these big questions that was looming in the international security field of saying, okay, well, in the Middle East, there's all this talk about Iran getting this nuclear weapon. How are the Arab states going to react? And at the same time, thinking about what do international relations theories say about this, and at the same time thinking about ideas of what's happening in Iraq and sectarian fighting that's developing both there and throughout the region. It's all kind of coming together, and I was trying to make sense of this, and making sense, though basically from that first question that has to do with how these big structural changes taking place. So it kind of came in this way of going and kind of coming up with a number of visits to Cairo asking these questions, and people just kept talking about the identity issues and that had nothing to do with the questions that I was raising. You know, of course, one could say, well, they think I'm somebody important, which I don't understand why, but they would think this and trying to push some issue or agenda that might be that. But I think it kind of had more to do with this, and that's what really kind of sparked this idea of looking at having something to do with ideas, ideology, and of course religion being one of the most dominant sources of this ideology that seems to play out in politics in the region at this period.
I've got to stop you here a second. It's really kind of interesting. You were earning your PhD at the University of California, Los Angeles. And for those of you who don't know anything about graduate school or different types of graduate schools, UCLA has a flavor for being, at least when I was there, a very political economy, rational choice-y school. The role of ideas and religion or theology really is not something that is big or talked about in the halls around there. How was it received when you said, hey, I'm going to do international relations and ideology stuff?
Well, I think, I mean, there was certainly some pushback, but probably at the stage that I shifted that way, I basically had to get into the academic shop talk. My advisors, I had co-chairs of Leonard Binder for the late Leonard Binder for the Middle East side, and Debbie Larson, obviously for the international relations side of things, and both were certainly sympathetic to looking at this way. Even say for instance from Leonard Binder, much more of that type of rational choice, qualitative aspect of approaching politics, but still without dismissing any role for what it means to actually understand and be in the region and still think about how people are thinking about politics. And so that's kind of, once it basically I had done a lot of the requisite training in the fields, in the skills that would be part of what you would consider this very hardcore rational choice political economy side of things, I kind of was left to do what I wanted to do, and I felt like I made a pretty solid case. And I think also at that point I had developed enough of my own path and perhaps even confidence at that level, saying this is the way I'm going to do it and let's see what happens. And so in that aspect, I think people kind of left you to your own doing. Of course, from the very beginning they're advising you to say you got to get these skills, and I'd say they're very, very important skills to have for graduate students, and they should have them, and that is really what you need to have on the market. But I guess I got lucky, or I guess I was fortunate enough to make a compelling case enough for my research and its trajectory for the future.
Yeah, I think you actually have benefited from that background training in the political economy, rational choice stuff, and then bringing in ideology too, because it's these schools of thought oftentimes don't talk to one another. And if you can bridge these gaps in ways, you can find creative answers to things. And that's what I really think you do in this book. And it's actually a very well-written book and brings together ideational considerations alongside what we would consider to be more economic or realist assumptions. And I want to talk a little bit about that now, because a number of our listeners come from religious studies programs, history programs, so they might not know the lingo of international relations that much. There's a school within international relations theories that is known as realism, and they generally argue that conflict between nation states revolves around material resources and determinants of power and things like that, maybe strength of military. There's another school of thought that is out there called constructivism that usually puts a lot of emphasis on the role of ideas. Give us some insights into what these different schools of thought are and then where you fall into that. I think it's going to help us understand your book a little bit better.
Yeah, I'll also connect that very well to the title. I would call myself a realist at heart to some extent, thinking really how important structure is in the region. Maybe I'm also torn and I've got these schizophrenic identities, or maybe I don't want to see what I'm thrown in. But I really, in terms of realism, I think you described it pretty well, and some of the basic tenets that we know in terms of many of the assumptions, although they're variants of the nation state being kind of this, a lot of times the unit of analysis, or we're talking about states that way, and about really just thinking about them as being the actors and trying to understand conflict and cooperation based on material factors, if it's military power or shifts and balances causing these outcomes, whether it's war and, you know, things like war and peace. And I'll get into it later of why or how that kind of framed how I was going to approach this subject and my initial assumptions about that states should be doing this if we, you know, if we assume that they're threatened by these changes in military power. And then on the other side, I think also you kind of explain constructivism and its variance well. What was kind of with its initial, or say like its heavy emphasis on the role of identity, and in this way of international relations, kind of understanding it as also, you know, since it's international relations, understanding to some extent conflict and cooperation, at least that's the constructivism I was trying to identify, and seeing the way I tried to apply it is saying, okay, in thinking about it, do state identities matter when it comes to conflict and cooperation? And if so, how or why? If not, you know, also why or why not? And I kind of found in that way that there's various literatures of sometimes cooperation, having similar identities can lead to conflict, and sometimes can lead to cooperation. How or why do we understand that? And one of the influential books that, you know, that that had an impact on me as well from graduate school is, of course, Michael Barnett's book, Dialogues in Arab Politics, that addresses some of these questions as well as the ideologies. And the same thing would go with another very influential book for many people, Origin of Alliances by Stephen Walt, who applied these sort of neorealism to the Middle East. And I tried to find my way in somewhere to these two excellent works and figure in where that would go. And so what I tried to do, and I think the title captures it quite well, is really try to bring those two together by, and maybe even a third one, by bringing in religion a little bit, through Islam and the balance, meaning this balance is obviously about balancing politics and playing off this realist conception of the balance of power, but Islam meaning this important cultural identity and how it's used in terms of promoting threats, or how it's really used to draw and push this ideational power, ideological power for other people outside of the academic field, and how these states can draw on this, and how these ideas can potentially threaten as well.
Yeah, and that's a really important thing, that ideas can threaten or can be used as weapons. The realist school, when it comes to balance of power, they're usually counting tanks or nuclear missiles and where people are lining up on this border or that border. And that's what we normally think of when we say weapons. But there's other things that can matter quite dramatically, such as ideas. And ideas can threaten here. And that's where you really kind of play out in this. Now, your whole story is about how nation states interact with one another, how they either cooperate or, more importantly, conflict with one another. You're bringing that to the table. And you talk about something known as the security dilemma. And specifically, there is an international security dilemma, but you change the lingo a little bit to, you know, shift the focus of people's attentions to the ideational security dilemma. So tell us what the security dilemma writ large is, and then the ideational security dilemma.
Okay, yeah, that's great. And actually, what I wanted, actually, if it's okay to go back a little bit,
sure.
Was going to talk about this idea of threats, and I think it'll tie in, or ideational threats. Another kind of motivation was that it was interesting, you know, this, and it connects to this ideational power, is that soft power, for instance, is you know, kind of the best-known term that's closely related, and but it's often thought of ideas, or people often think of ideas as this really positive force, you know, for instance, soft power. Some of the pushback I initially got is like, well, soft power is kind of like this good thing. And I think I called my initial dissertation or something that way. But that's what I was trying to, I think you picked up on this, flip it and say, it's not always that these ideas people push or promote are great. You know, we can think of plenty of examples. Just think of it from the flip side of how we understand or understood communism or communist influence or ideology. Well, we certainly didn't understand it that way, and they saw our ideologies as a threat, too, during the Cold War. So that's what I kind of wanted to
Yeah, let me go ahead. Let me get back to you up a minute and ask what soft power is and why people thought soft power was used for good things. I mean, soft sounds great. I'm thinking bunny slippers now. But what is soft power, and why is it? Why do many scholars and some of the folks on your committee thought, well, that's always a good thing?
Oh, I shouldn't say that some of them thought, they all thought it was a good thing that way. That it was more, it was kind of outside of that. But I think in part the way it's understood to be very closely associated with American values and culture, and what we want to promote is saying here are values and culture, and it's an idea or way to influence decision making or targets through, so that's the power of attractiveness. And so anyway, the fact that it's kind of first associated with the United States, and we think, of course, as soft power is a great thing. And then, I kind of trace this development. It was interesting, and not in the book, but if you see it in terms of a lot of the states start to adopt this, and also a lot of policymakers say, oh, this state wants to use its soft power this way, that way, and it's a concept where each state would think like their own ideas are a positive influence in what they want to get or achieve or accomplish. And of course, we think ours are with these values that we want to promote. But each state within its own, and that's where kind of I wanted to get to, remembering that if we're trying to analyze politics, we also want to analyze from various states of their own threat perceptions of how do they see these, outside of a normative aspect of whether it's right or wrong, or we think it's the best policy. We still need to know what they do or think.
Is soft power usually associated with diplomacy?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So the other thing, public diplomacy, a lot of times these values we might want to promote in certain aspects. Those types of those types of things that it may be setting up cultural centers to say, oh, here, or giving scholarships. And then there's always this, fuzziness in terms of the whether it's 100% soft power, is it supposed to be pushing away from that material aspect, or how do you divide that from ideas that way?
Yeah, I kind of get that, because I've worked with folks in the religious freedom policy arena, and there's this kind of concept of soft power. So we go to another country and convince them that this idea of religious freedom is a really cool thing. You should change your laws a little bit. Maybe we bring along James Taylor. He sings a few songs. it seems all pretty good. But as you point out, that in some ways can be a little bit threatening.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that kind of forms in a sense. That's the essence in part to the way that I see. This is how ideas can threaten in this way. I do it in a different way, getting more to the argument and saying what really helps motivate is these ideas, how they can be destabilizing potentially for a regime and why. And I'll talk about that in a bit. But going back to the question of the ideational security dilemma, starting with a regular security dilemma, just meaning what we kind of understand as being the heart of international relations of. So you've got two states, and you can even think about it as two different people, and one wants to. Your ultimate goal, of course, is survival, and to do that, whatever actions you take, maybe you might think of them being defensive in some way. They may scare your adversary or your person next to you, or the state next to you, because they might think, oh, this person's going to attack. They're making themselves stronger, but they may be, ready to do that type of thing, And the issue is it deals with a lot of questions of uncertainty, communication, things like this. But you sometimes get unintended conflicts when things can spiral. And what I wanted to do to translate that as well to the international sphere, whereby you may have statements, and this happens domestically sometimes, where there may be whole stories about domestic politics and shoring up legitimacy, or acts that really are about a domestic story, and they end up having international repercussions. And I think we can think of so many examples that we can't even remember a specific one at this period of time of when there might that happen, when it's about domestic politics and something plays out in the international sphere because it sounds very different to your neighbor. And this I can probably tie this in as well to other ways of how states may be able to discern these issues of projection, but you know, if it comes to your own domestic problem programs of why a state may be Islamizing, but why it is or isn't a threat, is what I'm kind of jumping ahead to this. But states will mostly only fear it if they feel it's being projected outwardly. And that's part of the argument I make. But I'll get back to that. I'll get back to that later because I've gone on a little bit more.
Well, I was just thinking of an example that was in the news recently. We're recording this on December 7th, and I think it was 2 or 3 days ago that President-elect Donald Trump took a phone call or made a phone call to Taiwan to talk to the president. Right. And he's saying, well, they're just talking, saying, hi, how you doing? I'm a new leader here. I'm coming in January. It didn't seem like that would be a big deal, but it really, really raised hackles in the People's Republic of China.
Right. Right, exactly. I mean, I was thinking, like, if you wanted to, I have a, you know, maybe, I'll take a take on it from the domestic position of that type of phone call, saying, oh, he just wanted to continue some type of, you know, the line that he might have about pushing back hard on China or something like that, and it was all a domestic politics story. That would be an example. You know, if that's what, you know, played out in reality, that would be a great example of how it can affect the international sphere. And then, obviously, the potential of an escalation of a certain sort and, you know, and how these types of words might lead to conflict. And that gets kind of part of the idea of it may not always be about shifting around militaries or increasing military power that you have or economic power, and it may be just sometimes these words or ideas can kind of spiral out of control or cause these states to do that.
So let's go ahead and dig into that, the ideational security dilemma and how these ideas could affect domestic political stability in another country. You say something here in our country, a ambassador says something, or you decide to have some kind of diplomatic initiative that says, you know, these things are really good, we like these things, and it could have a threat abroad. How does that play out?
Well, one way is, one way is clearly a question of maybe this other state is intending to, could be projecting these types of ideas, and they may be ideas that could have some resonance among a population that whose preferences or interests could be at odds with the regime. This happens. This is a common case where the people's same things, their preferences and interests, are not always in line with their regimes in the Arab world. That's that's an example, and that's clearly why I write about this in part. And if it's something to do with what critics might call them a quote secular leader or something like that. A leader of a president of a republic of an authoritarian regime, and it's not Islamist enough, so another leader might talk about that from a domestic perspective, and then if they do kind of project this idea, they'll say this country isn't pure enough, or this country isn't this, or we need to somehow purify Islam, and we have the right answer. So that's how it kind of can play out on those various levels, and I think I kind of describe it as being having a number of different levels involved, and that's the kind of the best way to articulate it.
Yeah, you use a couple examples of how seemingly innocuous symbolic actions can have a huge impact in other parts of the world, and the two examples that you use are the Danish cartoon affair and the actions of this Mohamed Bouazizi, who is the Tunisian street vendor who immolated himself in protest and basically set off the Arab Spring. So perhaps use two of those to kind of give an example of how just seemingly soft symbolism has a huge impact on the security of different regimes.
Right. It's also something I think it's fascinating to think how, you know, our initial reactions probably also the Danish cartoon, or I don't say are, because we have many different listeners from different perspectives, but many people are saying, well, how is this cartoon, we understand how people be upset, affecting politics to this extent, why is it being played out? And I don't think, I think understanding how and why versus that normative sense are two different things, but that idea of it, there are clearly, whether people like it or not, a lot of people that are upset by it, and there's sometimes often symbols for other grievances that are taking place. This is just one way to let's mobilize a lot of people that that may have different types of grievances and they all may be able to direct them toward the regime. The Danish cartoon scandal might not be that one, but it could be something like anything to do with Israeli policies in the Arab world. A lot of times are much more about Palestinians and or U.S. foreign policy in the region. And this can be a way to protest, yet at the same time, this could be also a lot of times understood as a protest against the regime and its policies. But there's something also that's really striking and about the two examples that you brought up, that I had brought up, but there are plenty of others, that really captures people's attention in a certain way. And why those and not others when similar events have taken place? I mean, we know what you know, what somebody lighting themselves on fire could mean, and we remember the images from the Vietnam War. But those are the types of things that really bring people together and pull on something a lot of times among sort of a cultural type of a shared cultural identity and symbols and history. And that's where I tried to get at. When the importance or power of the symbols are that they really draw on a shared cultural identity. Even if people aren't religious or they are or something like that, if they come from a similar type of tradition or they're aware of these symbols, they kind of know what they mean to the other person. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, somebody's invoking something religiously or having to do with some aspect of your history, it doesn't mean that you're going to be religious that way too, but you understand what that meaning is and also what it means to somebody else.
How much, you talk about cultural identity and the culture is a way that we transforms across boundaries. How much does geographic space play into this? One of the things that you do in your book is talk about how closely countries are to one another in terms of borders. But again, culture can transcend borders pretty quickly.
Right. Yeah. So that was, I think even in rethinking it a little bit more, one of the aspects that that's important in this is in terms of also what types of, I think geography could also matter in terms of what issues there are that would resonate when it comes to political issues. For instance, if you talk about the Middle East, Palestinian issues would matter more to the core part of the Middle East than they would to when it comes to politics and say all the way across North Africa, even though they will resonate that same way and they certainly draw people into the street, but they don't affect the everyday lives. They haven't throughout the modern Middle East history that they had in the past. And anyway, to that extent, that's partly what also drawing on is that these issues can resonate across wide swaths of territory, in part because this culture can extend that way, but the local circumstance may elevate some issues more than others.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that you bring up, and I think this kind of rounds out the theoretical aspect of your book, is you note that ideas can threaten the security of regimes, and regimes will counter-respond. They will try to ideationally balance. Now, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's another academic speak, as we know, versus how it translates to the rest of the world, or perhaps outside the discipline. We could call it even ideological balancing, which may even be more also still confuse. But it's really this idea of, if taken from that perspective of, we know, or one of the theories of international relations is that states will balance against the strongest military threat. It's a theory, or we'll say an approach of this, a concept about the balance of power. And what I wanted to get at, too, was there's also this balancing against the strongest or this projection of some type of ideological power that's taking place. And it's done, as you mentioned, there are a number of different ways to do it. It's not just I'm going to build up the military or economics. There's a number of actually domestic policies that occur as well, and it responds more directly to the actual threat that that these ideas contain for the regimes themselves. And this has to do with through counterframing and, as I mentioned, resource mobilization. And the resources in that way are ways to mobilize resources that will eventually kind of change the landscape of what of ideas, of the way people might think locally about their own regime to really bolster their own stability. And the counter-framing are various tools that the regime may use. And this is, remember, this is a battle of information, mm-hmm. of either to attack its attacker or its enemy by saying it's an illegitimate source, denying that it even exists by ignoring it, ignoring the media. A way to kind of shift the debate and those types of things. I mean, I talk about four different tactics, but that's the general approach to things.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're bringing this up. We had a podcast recently with Anne Wainscott, and we'll link back to it, where this stuff goes on in Northern Africa, Northwest Africa, with Morocco is being very threatened by Saudi Wahhabism, and they're promoting or pushing Sufism via the promotion of schools and getting imam clerics into seminaries that, you know, talk about this kind of Islam, this kind of idea, instead of that kind of idea, which is really kind of neat.
Right. I'm sorry to interrupt. I was going to ask the other add to it is, I've done some other work on this too, outside of the book, or even after it, 'cause it's been very close to one of my interests is, and I talk about this in the book as well, the idea of really bolstering what would be called official Islam or state-sponsored religious institutions, and that's partly what I think she's getting at too. And it's a very powerful tool because you can use the power of the state. And the downside is you could be potentially delegitimizing your own political authority by relying on this, and also you could be delegitimizing this religious institution because people know it's in service of the state. But the idea of this, so to speak, official Islam or state-sponsored religious institutions are definitely a powerful tool for some of these states to use, and basically to be their spokesman or mouthpiece. If we're talking about in the religious sphere, who's going to be the better to speak for the state than this official Islam? I mean, technically, it would probably be the popular person, but you just hope that they're 100% more independent. They're 100% independent, so, and they're understood and perceived that way, so they'll have more credibility.
Yeah, let's go ahead and dig into some examples that you use in this book. You talk about Iran and Sudan as examples of Islamic states that threaten the neighboring states of Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and then talk about how each of these countries, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, respond to one another. I think a lot of people might figure, oh yeah, Iran makes a lot of sense, but Sudan is one of these cases that I think most people would say, first of all, where is Sudan? And then second of all, they have an Islamic state and it's threatening? So let's go ahead and dig into this and start with the more common example, or the more known example, of Iran. What is Iran doing that threatens some of these neighboring states, and how do they respond?
Right. So that kind of, yeah, definitely gets at the whole, basically the crux of the book from the empirical perspective. Iran is actually, maybe I'll backtrack and kind of put it back into the framework of the main question of how do ideas threaten. And what I wanted to do was to show, if you're going to do this, I want to see in times of there's a shift in some type of balance of power, or a period of time where you'd think that the military, the amount of military power should be threatening to another state, and it's not, and that's a good something to draw on, or that if the military, declines, if you're saying from this realist perspective, the military power declines, threat perception should decline too, but it doesn't, and that's kind of to highlight those periods which this happens. And so I look at Iran in terms of this fluctuation of military power, and very briefly after the Iranian Revolution, their military is in part decimated because their officer corps is exiled, killed, and there's a, as you can imagine, in a war, there's a lot of loss of military power. I mean, sorry, in a revolution, this could happen with all this chaos, and after this period of time, in that way, what really takes shape is this immense power coming from a social revolution and this projection that they have throughout the region. And this is really what scares a lot of the Gulf countries in particular. And since then, this has been the sort of the constant, but there have been fluctuations in terms of how they've how they've projected these revolutionary ideas or values over time. And that's what I try to look at, both from the perspective of Egypt, who also were, and along with Saudi Arabia, allies in the 1970s, and this shifts after the Iranian Revolution. And with Sudan, the interesting thing is that there wasn't really a period that they were ever strong or powerful militarily, and so that's why it kind of shows that you can see these changes, and especially after 1989 is the event that you alluded to of how or why they become this self-proclaimed Islamic Republic, when Islamists from basically within, there's a military coup and they happen to be Islamists, take over and proclaim, this Islamic Republic and say they're pushing through all of this legislation and these are the values. And they're really, though, heavily supported by a very important figure, Hassan al-Turabi, Sheikh Hassan al-Turabi, who knows many languages, who's really speaks to, is well educated and also Western philosophy, but also is seen as a, or many might follow it, also in the Arab world as a reformer, as a religious reformer, but along those certain lines. And he's seen as basically this brainchild of and this promoter of these types of ideas. And that's when we get to this idea of, okay, where I try to look at it after Islamists come to power, how does it affect the relations between Sudan and Saudi Arabia and Sudan and Egypt, which again once were allies in various periods in the 70s and in the 80s.
Yeah, let's back up and do Iran, because that's one of these interesting things. And again, for people who are not all that familiar with the region, you say, okay, 1979, there's a revolution and some ayatollahs come to power. So, yay, verily, we get this theocratic government. Islam becomes more important. Now, one would think Saudi Arabia would be happy by that. They're kind of emphasizing Islam. They're sitting at the seat of power in Islam with Mecca and all that kind of stuff. So you'd think they'd be pretty happy about it. Egypt might be a little bit different of a story, because I think back in 1979, they had a much more of a secular regime. So tell us how the image of the Iranian Revolution, and to what extent did the new powers in Iran actually project these ideas of a regime, and how did that threaten Saudi Arabia, and how did it threaten Egypt in the 80s?
Right. I think in part, well, there are a number of different aspects to this. One is an idea of just basically there's some big revolution that takes place, and how do you get your hand around this? How do you get your head around this? Because these are dictatorships that are fearing the same thing from their own population, the same thing, and they could see themselves in that position, especially when they were just basically friends with much more so with Sadat and the Shah, and they couldn't, and then all of this happens, because they could say, oh wow, this just happened to me, what's going on here? But then it becomes more of a question of how does it threaten? And for Saudi Arabia, it's similar and yet different for both Egypt and Saudi Arabia. For Saudi Arabia, it comes down to a lot more of leadership of the Islamic world. And yes, the huge difference is one of the things I draw out, is it does cut across the sectarian divide, and this is, in fact, used in a lot of ways to combat or to bolster support, especially in Saudi Arabia, for saying, and also in Egypt, too, at various times, to say, these guys, don't be so attracted to these ideas. Remember, they're Shia ideas. They're not Sunni like us, and they're also not even, they're not even the same, from the same ethnic group. But so for Saudi Arabia, it's a lot of ways, it's a challenge to their leadership in the Islamic world, which is very closely connected to the regime, and basically, well, say connected to domestic political stability, the regime meaning the House of Saud and its relationship also to the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia. There are also aspects of which the types of challenges that the message that the Islamists taking over, will say when the Islamic Republic of Iran is established, of what types of messages they're saying, if it's attacks against Saudi Arabia in terms of having a monarchy, it's attacks of the way Islam is practiced, it's attacks of the corruption and the moral I'll say the moral depravity of some of these leaders that claim themselves to live by Muslim values. Those types of things of drawing these attacks and using it in symbolic ways, if it's if it's picking up in a universal symbols this way, and also a relationship with the West. And these translate also in a certain sense of to Egypt too. And Egypt also, you know, it may be thought of that way as more, I wouldn't say even a secular republic. Sadat, was a deeply religious man and in part used religion as well. And in fact, in the 1970s, helped support many of the groups that would later come to oppose him among many of the Islamists, in part to battle kind of balancing or against some of the leftist or communist influences, especially in the 1970s, early 70s. This was also a challenge of who would be the one to speak for Islam, where his version of Sadat might be much more of a tolerant, as at least he claimed it, because everyone's going to say they have a tolerant version. This is the right version, this is the way, it's moderate, and this is the way you people have always gotten along. And this is where this kind of battle goes back and forth. And with Iran, with the Islamic Republic, it's saying, you know, there's something about the legitimacy of this leader who's not leading a Muslim majority country and not doing so justly and repressing and so forth. And look at the policies and look at the in domestic and as well as foreign policies, and you can see these contradictions. And it's really attacking at those aspects of political legitimacy that, especially around the around religion, and for Saudi Arabia, if it's basing its legitimacy in part around this, it's even more of a challenge for them.
So how does Saudi Arabia and Egypt counterbalance the influence, the ideational influence of the Iranians? Do they get together in an alliance, and does Egypt say, hey, Saudi Arabia, we got a problem here. You have Mecca, that's central part of Islam. Let's get together and broadcast Sunni Islam, or we'll set up some schools or train imams in some way or another. How do they counterbalance Iran?
Well, the way I looked at it is more of within the state policies themselves, but there's certainly levels of coordination, and the coordination you could see taking place at a level of if it's mobilizing people for the Iran-Iraq war would be one example. Whether they coordinate the statements and saying, "Oh, we're going to have these religious leaders release a statement at the same time," maybe from time to time. But what you see in terms of parallel are these promotion or these resource mobilization in both sides, in both countries, domestically, where it is supporting their religious institutions for ideas that would support the legitimacy of their respective regimes that way. So meaning if it's promoting messages, it's saying, our version of Islam is tolerant or something like this, or adding money or training to more religious clerics, and this, by the way, happens now or today, and also in other ways of countering, just to kind of throw it off, countering violent extremism of having, you want to have more people promoting your ideas out there and speaking in mosques than to have people that are going to undermine it. So those are some of the ways. The other ones is if you see actually in terms of, as I said, mobilizing for something, this international, when it comes to together, the Iran-Iraq war, of how they're mobilizing against Iran and how Arabs come together against Saddam Hussein and do this both on, say, here's this Shia threat, and this becomes sectarianized, Shia and also Persian threat. It's often the two are often very much conflated, even though that's not entirely accurate. And we have this threat, and it's a way to coordinate internationally beyond the individual domestic policies that take place, and it's also seen as how does this translate domestically all the way. Oh, by the way, there's this Iranian threat throughout the region, and it's also a domestic one too, having to do with disrupting social order, and you should be afraid of it. Therefore, you should support the regime.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn now to Sudan and that's an interesting case. You already mentioned a little bit about the 1989 revolution. Give us a little background on that, because I'm not all that familiar with the 1989 Islamist revolution in Sudan. So what happens there, and how does it affect Egypt, which is the closer state, but also Saudi Arabia?
Right. So what's actually interesting is Numeri is in power before then, in the 1970s and 80s. And to backtrack a bit, and he's also supported by the Saudis and the Egyptians. And the Egyptian-Sudanese relationship has always been very close. These areas have been connected. It's connected historically. They're interlinked in terms of trade, and certainly some of the peoples, northern part of Sudan, being largely considering itself to be Arab. The water connects, and this is the lifeblood of Egypt. You can see these types of connections. And the reason why I mentioned the 1980s is it's kind of interesting because Numeri actually takes on, and from the late 1970s, an internal Islamization program. And certainly the Saudis aren't upset about this, because they like to see these types of programs. In 1983, they declare these September laws, which are kind of, these are certainly harsh Islamic laws that are imposed on the population. And they're also fighting the civil war in the south, which actually re-sparks it that period of time. But the important point here is what it does or doesn't do to Saudi and Egyptian threat perception. And as I said, the Saudis are kind of pleased by this, and Egyptians aren't really, they're kind of concerned with other bigger issues. They're not crazy that it sparks this fighting again, and because they're worried about chaos, and they're primarily worried about what's going on with the water from the Nile. But then what happens in 1989 is there's a large period of instability, in part because of this fighting in the civil war, and eventually through kind of a quiet coup, not so much of a quiet but one, but these Islamist these officers they're happen to be Islamists, take over power in July of 1989, and then it then basically proclaim or in this way, and potentially it could be, you could say, well, from the early 80s this is heading in this direction of Islamization, but they really bring it to the fore. They come from a Muslim Brotherhood background this way, and that's why, you know, if you see it from the perspective of Egypt or even its own Muslim Brotherhood, it was interesting. It's interesting to look at of how do they perceive this. Of, you know, there's got to be some aspect of jealousy, saying, "Oh, these guys came to power. We've wanted power for a long period of time, and these Islamists got power." And you can imagine what that would do for also the Egyptians, saying, "Oh, well, this is what could happen if we potentially liberalize, or if we let these guys have their own. They're going to get the state, and we've been warning." We're warning about this for a long time.
You said something interesting there that just kind of caught my attention, and I think you do well in your book. You kind of blending the realist assumptions with the constructivist assumptions here. You mentioned that the Muslim Brotherhood looks at this case in Sudan, and you would think ideationally, if you just had a pure ideational perspective on this, that says, "Yay, brothers! You know, we've been fighting with you, so this is great. We're rallying around you." But you also mentioned they kind of felt jealous by this, right? This, they all of a sudden, organizational interests come in and saying, "Oh, we wanted to be the top dogs when it comes to promoting this type of Islam, and now you folks get it before we do. Boy, we're angry by that."
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think, like, yeah, what it actually means in practice, it's. But I could imagine that's got to be, that's sort of the case. It's actually something that I wanted to delve a lot more into, and I wasn't able to do it. I think it actually would be a fascinating subject to really go into and say, how did they really see this at the time, and what effect did it have? Because I mean, it really, ultimately, I don't think it really had any effect in terms of policy, but it's still interesting to, in terms of their own philosophy and projection for the future of saying, well, it was done. Nexus, we know the Iranian revolution, even though we don't agree with the approach to Islam that they have, we know it was done, and there's a potential social revolution. And then we have these guys next, you know, these guys beneath us, and I'll say beneath us in a variety of ways, and they did it. And then, but I think, like, as I was saying, the most important thing is saying, think if you're in Cairo, if you're Mubarak, seeing this and going, "Wow, these guys just got in power.
Yeah.
What could happen to me next?"
Right, right. No, that's a big issue. So how do they counterbalance? How does Egypt and Saudi Arabia counterbalance this?
Well, in a lot of the same ways. In part, again, through these counter messaging aspects of, if it's something like, I mean, for Sudan, you can easily say that to some extent, you can undermine a same thing, and this is done in op-eds as well, of saying, oh, really, you guys think you're this pure moral force in the world? And they kind of play up the fact that they're so poor, that Sudan is so poor, and we have this, and we're suffering through these sanctions, and we're so, later on, and that we're, we care more about ideas and values than anything else. But then you can easily say, oh, is this the type of government you want? They're in this terrible civil war. They're one of the poorest countries in the world. And yet, you know, they're supposed to be governing you. This is not probably what you want in terms of Islamic governance that way. It doesn't have to do with Islam and so forth. So that's an easy way. Another, of course, is other ways of saying how these ideas are threatening to, for instance, from the Egyptian perspective, how they sponsor terrorism, how they're in cahoots with Iran, and there is this alliance in the 1990s as well. And both are thought to be these crazy revolutionaries that will bring the country a lot of disorder. And they're against the Egyptian national interests of what it really means to be Egyptian and have stability and have a tolerant form of Islam versus this extremist one that we saw in Saudi Arabia. I'm kind of pulling from a lot of types of op-eds or these opinions that I remember seeing, because they're actually pretty exciting to read at the time, where you see, as much as they're inflammatory, they're kind of telling a lot of times of what the regime might want, you know, or their mouthpiece, their spokesman are close in certain thoughts. Because the good thing is, as you know, in this period of time, there really isn't that much press freedom. It's mm-hmm. much more controlled. And even if they're not being told what to say in some of these op-eds, they know that they're going to say certain things. They're not outside of a certain realm. And then to Saudi Arabia as well. Oh, sorry, did I... does similar things in terms of supporting their own state religious institutions, pushing more resources in that direction, and really trying to... but with Saudi Arabia, though, it's much more of a denial when it comes to Sudan. I mean, they were both... The tricky part is they were both really, really, put it mildly, upset with Sudan for its role in the Iraq War. But with Saudi Arabia, when it came to actual threats, and this has done it before... is it didn't talk about it very much. It's done this, I mean, it did this when the siege of Mecca in 1979 for a number of days. It just kind of denies and cuts off that this even exists in this way. And you don't see that much talk about it until basically these attacks. And there is some big discussions about Tarabi, how he does or doesn't represent values of Islam, or how he's a potential threat, what he does. So that's kind of, a lot of the same types of policies exist, where this resource mobilization and the four tactics that I outline in counter-framing or denial and undermine the credibility of the spokesman of that messenger or that symbol.
You mentioned something about press freedom in these two countries, in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and so they're pushing this idea that these Sudanese, they're not really that legitimate, that's a poor country. How do you think that message is received internally? How effective do you think it is? And I this is a little bit outside of the scope of what you're writing about, but I'm always curious about that, because you try these counter framing techniques and people pick up the newspaper and people on the street who are thinking, well, should I kind of join a revolutionary movement as well, or should I just go home and watch TV? And you pick up a newspaper and you see the official mouthpiece of the regime saying, yeah, don't pay attention to those Sudanese guys. And you're like, yeah, I don't know. It sounds like the counter-framing might either A, be ineffective, or B, be counterproductive in some ways.
Right. I mean, I think it can be both. And it really kind of depends on the timing. And the other thing is, it's really, as you said, it's kind of impossible to know. That's one of the biggest challenges, is knowing exactly without any type of public opinion in these experimental methods of, you know, of these tests and stuff like that, of saying, oh, how effective was this messaging campaign the government put out? And you can't really go by and saying, well, there are no protests or things like this, or there is no, there are no big movements, because that's, there's so many other factors involved. I mean, and it's also hard not to put ourselves in there and saying, well, this is, seems like a ridiculous type of counter-messaging campaign to embark on, that is anybody really going to take this seriously? I mean, it, ultimately, though, it could lead to just, it could be, you know, those kind of fence sitters that, that do want confirmation that this is the wrong thing, or maybe even fence sitters, people that want to lean toward the regime, that this these ideas are the wrong thing, and they want this other type of, this affirmation, just to know, yeah, this isn't the right way to go about doing things. And I think probably those that are already convinced it among the Islamist camp are not going to they're not going to be persuaded by this by any means, and that's not really who they're targeting for the most part. And I think in part the other thing is really just to make this make those challenges to the regime or those ideas outside of any type of political culture or discussion, so that it doesn't come close to threatening the legitimacy of the regime.
Yeah, let me switch gears a little bit and have you step outside your book. Again, your book was primarily concerned about Iran, the 1979 revolution, and how that has affected things over the past few decades, and Sudan, 1989, likewise. But there's this big thing going on now in the Middle East, ISIS or ISIL, and they have a big, huge ideational message, but they also have territory. And I can imagine that some of the regimes, most notably Syria, is kind of concerned about this, but neighboring regimes as well, Jordan and Saudi Arabia, Egypt, is probably going to be very concerned about this. If you took your analysis here and applied it to that situation, how would it play out?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I wrote about this in these short little essays in the Washington Post Monkey Cage. About how this works, how this plays out, and basically what or why these states fear the Islamic State, or the so-called Islamic State, wherever you want to call it. And so I was focusing, again, it wasn't that, you know, I was focusing, look, it's not, doesn't have the power of a, doesn't have the military power of the state. It has this power of ideas that are pretty powerful, and what are they? And I think in a certain way, it's potentially ideas that would resonate, and they may be actually counter, you know, they might be, of course, inspiring aspects of terrorism, as we've seen. But in a lot of ways, it's also promoting certain ideas that's challenging to the religious authority of the state. But for the most part, the and then, of course, if you see the kind of counter messaging from some of the regimes, and a lot of times it's against actually counter-radicalization, it's about saying what Islam is and isn't, and saying this isn't, you know, what ISIS does is not Islam, and of course what we're doing in our religious institutions is, and we know we have more of a claim on this, but so part of this was basically, and also seeing how this can spill over to how these ideas from that perspective can spill over to other territories, which could mean this, you know, if it is through radicalization, if it's through other types of terrorist action and so forth, it could challenge both the legitimacy and sometimes basically the state security. And more so in Jordan, you've got these populations, and of course in Saudi Arabia as well. With Syria, I think though it's such a crazy, you know, it's such a, I guess, already such a civil war that I think I would kind of leave it out at this point.
Yeah, it's involved right in the center of the heart of Syria, really. So the ideational perspective or projection is not as concerning as, oh, they're holding territory. Yeah.
Right. Well, I think the other thing to add is that the idea of a state versus a non-state, because it's ISIS is this, you know, is it a an insurgent group, a terrorist group, a so-called state, a quasi-state, who knows where it is. But even at least before the fall of Mosul, you know, we can say that this is, it's still considered to be this threat, and you could say it's more of a non-state than other things that way. That And so then it still projects this type of ideational power and threatens the, and undermines and some of its neighboring neighboring countries. In terms of, I don't think they're necessarily, they're not worried about them invading so much, coming through with these armies or expanding. It's this power of this idea of what would happen if this Islamic State is created there, that and what this would mean for the rest of the region. That's what I think is important to think more broadly about.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think having, if ISIS does obtain territory and holds it for a long period of time, again, we're in this gray area that, are they a state or are they not a state? Well, you know, they do have to get the electricity running in some places, so I kind of consider them a state now.
Right.
But it's not so much that security threat that they're going to pour across the border with a traditional army into Jordan, but that ideational threat. How do you think some of these countries are viewing this? More as an ideational threat, more as a security threat, or is it very much in flux?
Well, I think they're probably seeing definitely on the near term this security threat, if it's a border problem, refugees for Jordan, those issues, and of course the terrorism that exists. But I think in the, I mean, I would say in the broader back of the mind, and then of course like the state, what would happen with regard to ISIS is for the state system in Iraq and Syria, how that's going to play out. But I mean, I would say in the, I would say, I don't know if I could think the leaders, the back of their mind is, it's unfathomable that what if you had this so-called Islamic State that becomes normalized in this way? What would that really mean in the future if it behaves the way it does? But, you know, there are some that argue and say it's not going to behave the way it does. Like, it's going to be normalized in the system. But if it does behave the way it does, what is that going to do to the future legitimacy? Can you imagine, you know, if you thought Iran immediately after the revolution was bad, imagine what these guys are going to do, saying, you guys, look what we just did. We just captured this territory. We run a state. We have a large bureaucracy. We govern. And if they govern well, I mean, they haven't been, it doesn't seem, but, and if they govern well and they say, and we've got all these trappings, and look at you, Saudi Arabia, and look at you, you know, Jordan, and look at you, Egypt, you guys have all these problems. What is, you know, what do you have to say for yourself? About you and your Islamic values, and that's, or even just what do you have to say for yourself for governance in general? I shouldn't focus even so much on religion, because it's just saying maybe this is the best form to run things. Maybe there's something to be said there, and I think that's in a sense this longer, deeper threat beyond the very, very. I'm not downplaying by any means the type of security threats that play out when it comes to the border security, refugees, and just destabilization in general with regard to terrorism, but the longer, bigger threat of what that would mean. That's what would be consistent with my argument, and then seeing if this is the case, and then playing out this future Islamic State being able to project this power, you could see of how this would be threatening to these various regimes, because it probably won't be able to have a conventional military that could invade these. That's not going to be the main power of it. It's going to be these ideas and what it just did.
Yeah. One final question for you. You've been studying this for, you know, quite a while now, since the early 2000s, and thinking about it in an area that is really in flux and in the news a lot. Things change on a day-to-day basis. Over the course of your studies, has there been anything that has really surprised you or really made you change your mind about how you envision the world order or the international relations?
Yes, a lot. I think I'll backtrack, because it had to do with one thing I think you had mentioned, or at least it sparked me wanting to make a comment about this. Initially, and this kind of combines the way that I'd wanted to frame the whole project was more in a more general sense, and this ties into the idea of looking at you know, not just, and I try to draw on this a little bit, looking at actually the period in the 50s and 60s, how Arab nationalism was also this dominant ideology. So I didn't want to say, oh, it's all about religion. That's certainly not necessarily the message, just this is the one we talk about. And then also drawing it outside of the region, it was a conscious choice not to make these, not to basically bring in other regions in terms of writing, just because I felt like I wanted to write a book more about the Middle East than anything. But you can see examples from the early parts of the Cold War, you know, with the Comintern and the Common Form is these mouthpieces, and how they're pushing against this, and the Red Scare that happens in the United States. That was actually part of these parallels, these ideas. But what kind of shocks me, I guess, is when we have things like revolutions or aborted revolutions, so to speak, after the uprising in the Arab world. And that, in doing this project, I think also shocked me and, in a sense, partly scared me because I was in the finishing it, and then the uprisings occurred, and I didn't know where it was going, and I was worried I was going to be one of those people writing their book or dissertation in 1989 or 1990, yeah. And wasn't sure where it was going to go. that's one of the things I think what initially shocked me was even the uprisings and how it played out, and then also how it kind of, once it settled, to be honest, it was how many of the things I had talked about even after the uprising still were relevant. And, you know, in five years, it may not be. You know, my book might be kind of this historical artifact in maybe in 2 years. But both sides kind of surprised me. I don't know if that quite answered. I think you're probably getting at what have you kind of learned from all this, but in this aspect. But I think in part it was more of the power of ideas and identities that I know that they're important, and I felt that they're important. I've got this this tear on me about military power, how you can go, and some of the other work I've done in policy, I talk about that primarily, but I've got this other side of me that says, well, you just can't get away from this, the power of ideas. And I think it's also something for us to really take seriously when, those thinking about foreign policy and other things, what strikes me of talking to people in sort of the defense community of thinking in the military, of they're talking a lot about bombs and bullets things, but a lot of times they're talking about the power of ideas in a positive and negative sense, in certain ways, and you really can't get away from that as much as you want to say the whole world is driven by balance of the power. Well, it's not entirely. It's much more complicated.
I think that is a lesson to be learned, and you do a very nice job in your book, Islam in the Balance, to realize the importance of these ideas and how they. In we fight with bullets, but we also fight with ideas in the international realm as well. So congratulations on that book. And my guest today has been Larry Rubin. Larry, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much for for the time and the opportunity to talk to your audience.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.